very much. So the title of my paper is Victorian Animal Machines, Prosthetized Animals in 19th Century Print Culture. But I'm going to begin with the contemporary moment. So from Ada, the goldfish with a buoyancy aid, through Darby, the dog with 3D printed prosthetic legs, to Crispy Bacon, the pig with wheels. The internet is filled with social media profiles, news stories, and cute videos featuring animals with prostheses. But where does the practice of fitting on humans with prosthetic aids come from? When did we become so fascinated with this veterinary phenomenon? And what range of emotions was elicited by animal prostheses in the past? The 19th century periodical press reveals that the history of prostheticizing animals has a much richer and deeper history than we might think. Indeed, not only were animals with prostheses depicted in Victorian illustrations and other cultural artifacts, but there is considerable evidence to suggest that real domestic and agricultural animals were fitted with artificial body parts in the 19th century too. From 1783, reports appeared in local and national newspapers and journals that described instances where farm animals, in particular cattle, were fitted with wooden legs following accidents that ended in amputation. These reports were rarities to begin with, but became more prevalent and were responded to more frequently as the 19th century progressed. By the 1890s, there were reportedly animal hospitals where wealthy pet owners could go to get their beloved non-humans fitted with all manner of prosthetics, ranging from false teeth to artificial paws. Investigating the interest in fitting animals with prostheses throughout the 19th century in Britain, this paper will explore the history of animal prostheses from their emergence in bovine agriculture through to their breakthrough into what historians have called the Victorian cult of pets. Primarily, I'm interested in what people thought of prostheticized animals. As I'll show through an analysis of journal and newspaper contributions, animal prostheses divided opinions. Emotional responses were varied, ranging from admiration and amazement to annoyance and disgust. In the remainder of this presentation, I'll trace these dominant responses. In doing so, I'll show how representations of animal prostheses were inflected by a variety of discourses, including those concerning economics, pet culture, social class, and gender. Attitudes to animals with prostheses were, I'm sorry to say, as unstable as certain impaired non-humans depicted in the sources themselves. As mentioned briefly, the practice of fitting impaired animals with prostheses appears to have begun in bovine agriculture before it infiltrated the world of pet keeping. But why did farmers bother experimenting with prostheses in the first place? One explanation for why certain farmers had injured cattle fitted with prostheses rather than having them euthanized comes down to simple economics. Indeed, as Harriet Ritvo and Don Broglio have demonstrated in their work on the history of bovine breeding practices, beef was big business in the 19th century. It was in fact big in two senses, because there was huge cultural investment supposed achievements of prize breeders, and since the cows that were produced by such breeding practices were truly enormous, so colossal in fact that we might today consider such beasts as bred to the point of severe impairment. Ritvo shows us that the breeding of huge cattle resulted from a response to changing social attitudes impacting Britain in the 19th century. And this is what she says. Increased food production was necessary to feed the rapidly expanding English population. In addition, as an island nation frequently at war with its closest neighbours during the period and potentially vulnerable to blockade, Britain needed to be able to provision itself. Meat was a particularly valuable commodity in international competition because the ability of especially urban industrial workers to buy it was an index of British commercial prowess, and because, according to popular belief, it was the consumption of red meat that distinguished brave and brawny English soldiers from puny, sniveling Frenchmen. Amidst this climate, the breeding of fat cattle, animals that could feed more and embody Britain's agricultural superiority, became a business with huge financial stakes. That pun wasn't actually intended, so sorry. In particular, because of its perceived suitability for both fattening and milk production, the shorthorn breed was viewed as without rival in this period. The high esteem that this breed held was reflected by hugely inflated market prices for pedigrees. In 1865, for instance, the Times reported 12 shorthorn cattle sold for £6,510, a figure relative to the income value of over £5.2 million in 2016. Meanwhile, considerable prizes were awarded at fat cattle competitions to winning breeders. Most famously, between 1843 and his death in 1861, Prince Albert won almost £1,000 in medals for his pigs and cattle, an income equivalent in 1861 to the economic power of almost £2.4 million in 2016. Such prizes seem to actualise the pioneering 18th century grazier Robert Bakewell's famous claim that a cow is, quote, the best machine for converting herbage into money. Given the high financial incentives, it's easy to see why for many farmers the practice of fitting injured cattle with prosthetic limbs made sense. If you could save a pedigree cow's life by having an injured leg amputated, you could make it productive again, able to feed, breed, raise young, and or produce milk. By having it fitted with a wooden leg, one could recuperate its status as a literal cash cow. With these factors in mind, we can begin to understand from one perspective why stories of cattle with prostheses appeared with growing frequency in the agricultural news sections of regional and national newspapers and periodicals. They showcased a supposedly inspirational form of human ingenuity that could reap large financial rewards. My archival research reveals at least 21 separate incidences of cattle being fitted with prostheses, but many of these stories were reprinted or retold multiple times across regional and national newspapers. While I've not yet had time to count them thoroughly, so far I've found approximately 80 news items in total. As mentioned, one dominant trope of such journalistic representations was the narrative of productive success. To provide an example of such a report, here's one from the 6th of June 1859 issue of the London one-penny newspaper, The Standard, which also appeared in at least 9 other regional newspapers within a 2-week span. I'm just going to read this to you. A cow belonging to Mr. Dan, farmer of Kelfield Lodge near Selby, had one of her forelegs broken on Martinmas day last by the kick of a horse. Mr. Shaw, veterinary surgeon of Stillingfleet, said that nothing short of an amputation would effect a cure. Mr. Shaw operated on the 4th of March. She calved a fine calf a week before and she brought it up. And now the animal possesses the advantage of a wooden leg. She's been turned out to grass and makes a wonderful shift for herself. What is clear in this example is the celebratory tone surrounding veterinary prowess and human ingenuity more generally. The phrase, "nothing short of amputation would effect a cure," portrays the vet's intervention as an act of heroism. It's worth noting that at this time, veterinary practitioners were vying to assert themselves professionally in terms of usefulness, social status, and recognition. And so positive representations such as this provided important publicity. Similar reports later in the century were entitled A Veterinary Triumph, and a particular veterinary surgeon, Mr. Snary of Norton, Northamptonshire, received high praise for successfully performing amputations and prosthesis fittings on cattle on 2 separate occasions. Returning to the Standard report, what is also implicit here is the apparent savviness of the farmer's decision to save the life of his cow. By letting the vet amputate his cow's leg, the farmer gained a, quote, fine calf brought up by its mother. Note the language used in this passage to describe the cow's recovery. She now makes, quote, a wonderful shift for herself, emphasising her supposed workmanlike qualities while borrowing from the nexus of the burgeoning factory system. The emphasis of this reportage is very clearly placed on celebrating what is seen as a utilitarian solution to an issue of productivity. Though we may speculate that it was mostly economically valuable cattle that were fitted with prosthetic limbs, sources from relatively early on in the wooden-legged cow trend reveal that an emotional as well as monetary economy was in operation with regard to certain bovine amputees. Some, it would seem, were fitted with prostheses out of compassion rather than for speculative economic gain. For instance, the following report appeared in the Perth Courier and was reprinted in the Sheffield Independent on the 29th of August 1829. Last week, a cow in the neighbourhood of Blair Gowrie received a severe injury in one of its legs, and in the hope that the parts would adhere, it was neatly and skillfully bound up. The bandages were not removed till it was supposed all was nearly right, but it was found that the member had become separated from the body. The cow was a peculiar favourite of the goodwife, the mistress of the house or farm, who bewailed grievously the misfortune. To appease her grief, a neighbour artfully constructed a wooden leg for Crummy, who is thereby enabled to go about her business like any other cow. Here, in spite of the use in the last sentence of language to do with productivity, her business, we get a sense that Crummy has received veterinary treatment and subsequently a wooden leg out of love rather than for monetary gain. Typically, though, for this period, there's a clear gendering and sentimentality that's directed towards the non-human. Note how the anonymous author, who it would seem is either a man or is at least posing as one, distances his position from that of the goodwife, whose compassion is shown to be expressed by emotional excess, bewailing grievously, and thus, by contemporary standards, feminine. Her attachment to the cow is described as peculiar, a word that since the 17th century could mean strange as well as particular. And the cow's name is encased in quotation marks, both moves that keep the compassion of the housemistress at arm's length. This distancing itself is slightly peculiar since, as Sarah Amato observes in her 2015 monograph, Beastly Possessions, pet keeping was seen primarily as a masculine domain until the late 19th century. But we can perhaps understand the slight estrangement of the reporter to the compassionate position as once again economically grounded. Later veterinary textbooks, such as Royal College of Veterinary Surgeon President George Fleming's 1884 work, A Textbook of Operative Veterinary Surgery, advertised against amputation to large animals in the majority of cases, because such procedures were believed to, quote, reduce them in condition for at least a considerable time and consequently greatly diminish their value. Though it would be remiss to assert that the writer of the, pardon my expression, Crummy report has such a sophisticated knowledge of the considerations to be made before having a cow fitted with a wooden leg, the tone of this reportage suggests a level of scepticism informed by similar principles. Outward criticism is perhaps tempered by the fact that Crummy's leg separated naturally, thus not requiring the cost of surgery. Considerable scepticism also infused the reportage surrounding the emergence of prostheticised pets from the mid to late 19th century, as attested to by histories of pet culture, including those by Keith Thomas, Harriet Riffo, and Hannah Belton. Pet keeping was by no means new in the 19th century, but it was during this period that it reached critical mass and as a result received considerable social commentary. Previously a pastime of the social elite, by the mid-century, pet keeping was a more widespread social activity. Ingrid H. Tabe's argument is that the democratisation of pet keeping began in the previous century following Britain's rise to economic dominance in Europe. As Tabe suggests, during this period, pets became increasingly visible indicators of spreading prosperity. By the late 19th century, For many commentators, this prosperity had turned to preposterousness, overindulgence, and gross sentimentalism. Ritvo demonstrates how, quote, Punch frequently satirised the foolishness of dog lovers who fed their pets from the table, dressed them in elaborate outfits, and allowed them to inconvenience human members of the household. I didn't see anything wrong with this. Along similar lines, in her book Beastly London, Boughton reports that by the early 20th century, veterinary practitioners publicly warned Londoners to resist the ludicrous luxuries of so-called dog toilet clubs, where products such as scented baths, perfumes, pocket handkerchiefs, fur coats, rubber boots, and various other anthropomorphic items could be purchased for a price that one lady vet wrote, quote, takes one's breath away. As I'll suggest in what remains of this talk, pet prostheses were considered somewhere between the veterinary successes of prostheticised cattle and the examples of pet care gone mad. Journalistic pieces such as Harold Macfarlane's 1899 Country Life Illustrated article, Animals and Birds as Patients, describes how by the fin de siècle, veterinary practice was so well established that beloved pets could get all manner of prosthetics fitted to help them cope with injuries and physical losses, ranging from splints and artificial limbs to false teeth. Macfarlane reported that, quote, about a year ago, there was exhibited at a certain show a very interesting and aged Schipperke, who was at the time the only dog in the world boasting a complete set of false teeth. His owner, Mr. Mosley, a dentist as well as a lover of animals, and it's entirely due to the skill that the little dog is able to eat with perfect comfort by the aid of the artificial molars provided to him by his master. Earlier sources suggest that Macfarlane's claim about the uniqueness of Mosley's dentured dog may not have been entirely accurate. Indeed, we learn from an 1875 Sporting Gazette article that a fox terrier with false teeth won first prize at a dog show in Manchester. According to the Daily Mail, yes, that reliable source, by the turn of the 20th century, fitting dogs with dentures was apparently quite commonplace. Their 1901 article at the Dog's Dentist reports that many dogs are going about the world with sets of false teeth. One West End lady has a dachshund who is so advanced in years that it's been recently invested with three new gold-plated teeth, while four have been stocked with the same precious metal at a cost of £15. For context, £15 in 1901 is relative to the income value of almost £9,000 in 2016. The stereotype of affluent, over-sentimentalised, often female pet owners over-investing economically and emotionally in their animal companions by having them fitted with prostheses was, as we might suggest, subject to ridicule in the late 19th century satirical press. For instance, a poem about Mosley's dentured dog published in Fun in 1897 ended with the lines, "That a myriad dogs delight to bite because the dentist made them so." Another example, which I show on the next slide, provides a more explicitly gendered humorous critique of the growing trend for animal prostheses. This illustration appeared in Funny Folk in 1877 as a response to recent reports regarding horses being shot after riding accidents. The image shows not only several horses with wooden legs, but also a dog with crutches in the bottom left-hand corner, and an elderly male rider to the far right, who also uses lower limb prostheses. Using hyperbole in the grotesque mode, the illustration suggests that such a future of mass prostheticisation is on the near horizon. What comes through strongly from the title, the lady's mile of the future, the centrality of the lady rider within the composition, and the inclusion of the loyal following prostheticised lapdog, is that this apparently absurd practice of prostheticising animals is the result of the influence of ladies, females of respectable social status with considerable financial means, who conform to particular codes of behaviour. In this regard, we can see how both class and gender inflected the humour and sense of revulsion that this image was designed to generate. Prostheticised pets and working animals were seen as extensions of an affluent culture that was being mocked for its extravagance. As we've seen then from this brief analysis, animal prostheses took off in a notable way in the 19th century, but attitudes towards them were by no means stable. While in certain cases, i.e. regarding valuable cattle, prostheses were treated with surprise and admiration as financially savvy solutions to perceived crises of productivity, representations of pampered prostheticized pets were often imbued with gendered and class-specific annoyance and disgust, though not without a flourish of humour. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thanks. Yeah, that was a fascinating talk. So you might be aware that